All right. Hi, everyone. I hope you had a good lunch. I'd like to introduce you to Owen, who's going to talk about access control, fine-grained access control in ORC. I think we had a similar talk for Parquet earlier.
Yeah, exactly. So we just had the Parquet talk. The Parquet guys are still here. So
this is a good fit, then.
They're going to keep me honest. Thank you, Lars. Who am I? I've been working on Hadoop since 2006. Oh, my God, that's a long time now. I was the tech lead for MapReduce and for adding security into Hot, and then I switched over to Hive and Orc, and I'm a technical fellow at Cloudera. Okay, so first I wanted to give a little bit of background about what security and data protection looks like in Hadoop. You have all these different use cases. People dump it all into the big data cloud, and you have different environments, right? You have different data centers around the world. You've got a lot of companies that, or a lot of countries, rather, that control where the data can be placed. So, you know, data in the EU has to stay in the EU. Data in China has to stay in China. You don't want to move all of it around because you can't change the legal boundaries for where the data is stored. And you've got a lot of the stuff that you really care about from a user's point of view. Right, you've got health data. That stuff has to stay private. Even the contact information, right? You really don't want more people having access to your address than the need to have access to your address. And certainly credit cards and financial information needs to be protected. And so protecting that data has become very, very important. And so in the big data ecosystem, when we started, there was no protection at all. At lunch, I was telling someone that when we started Hadoop, there were no owners on any of the files. Anyone could see anything, write anything. That lasted great until Google was teaching a class with Hadoop, and the student was done with their project, and so they did an RMR off of their home directory. Fortunately, they were one level too high and deleted everyone's home directory. Not so good. And so being able to prevent those kind of mistakes was the first piece of protection that we added into Hadoop, and since then we've been adding a lot more. So what's different about the big data context? First of all, the big data has gotten rid of a lot of the silos, right? More and more data is grouped together, and so that people don't have different silos for different data sets. They're all in the same place because that's really convenient. But it makes it much, much harder to control the data. Furthermore, you've got a lot more self-service on the data. So your data scientists actually have a lot of control over the data, and you need to be able to control who has access to it and what they can see. It's maintained over a long time. Companies used to purge their data after 90 days, now they just keep it around for years and years. Actually, some of the customers not only keep the data, they keep modifying backwards. I've got one customer that has data going back 15 years, and they keep having update records on those records from 15 years ago. Leads to a lot of challenges in the big data space. Finally, with the cloud and hybrid, you've got a lot of different control boundaries. Right. Sometimes you need to do additional processing in the cloud. You want to upload some of your data, but you don't necessarily want your private data going out to the public cloud. And so you want to be able to control things even when it moves across the different domains. And finally, you need a defense in depth because you never want to rely on a single line of defense to protect all of your data. Okay, this is a slide that the Ranger guys did, but the is your nice elephant protecting that's your data in your big data center. You've got multiple lines of defense. Your outside is your firewall. You should always have firewalls around your Hadoop clusters. Then you have a bridge, which is your entry point. So there you've got Nox, which provides a gateway. You use LDAP, or controlling who gets in. your hard walls are your encryption that you have at different spots. Your watchtowers, you've got Ranger that provides access-based or attribute-based access control, lets you do audits and lets you do different kinds of anonymization. There's Metron that lets you watch for events going on and detect them. And finally, at the very inner keep, you've got Kerberos that protects all of your services. So what does that data protection look like? From the storage layer, you've got encrypting the data while it's at rest. Currently, that's mostly the transparent data encryption in HDFS that lets you encrypt whole directories and put the keys into Ranger. You can also turn on transmission for the data in motion so that it's protected while it's in flight. And finally, you can protect the data upon access. That's the current model where you've got Apache Ranger doing row filtering and data masking and encryption there. So what do these different pieces look like? Volume encryption really says that you're encrypting everything on disk. That you turn on at the Linux level. That one really only helps you if you've got regulatory problems where you have to encrypt it when it's on at rest. And that will encrypt everything. The reason it doesn't protect you better than that is because if your system is up and running, those keys are in memory and the disk is mounted. So anyone who's on the system while it's running can see that data. Of course, it also saves you if people get access to your hard drives after they've been pulled out of a box. But most of the companies I have talked to, the only way disk drives leave a data center is as aluminum dust. So there basically isn't a huge demand for that, except for the regulatory ones. The other end, there's HDFS data at rest encryption. That lets you encrypt whole directories, and we're going to talk about that one more later. And in the middle, you get application-level encryption. What Ranger looks like, I want to talk a little bit about what the Ranger setup looks like. So the one at the bottom is your actual table with all the data. Now, Ranger can let you say, okay, the analysts who are in the U.S. only see the people in the U.S., and the people in the EU only see the people in the EU. And you can mask the fields and do a lot of dynamic masking depending on where they're coming in from. You can even do things based on what time of day they're asking the question. And so the same query can end up with very different results based on who's asking and what time it is and where they're asking the question. So it gives you a lot of flexibility in terms of what you control. Now, that said, it doesn't actually give you everything you want. That's a really flexible control. That's very dynamic. But what led us to the problem was that we have different systems, and we wanted to be able to access the data from Spark and from Pink and from Hive, and there was no common way of enforcing those restrictions across all of those execution paradigms. And so we wanted to build a framework to let us do that. And what did we need? We needed authorization. Who can see which columns? We wanted audit to track who had read it. And in particular, we wanted to keep track of, for every piece of the data, when each person had looked at it. And finally, we did want to be able to encrypt on disk. File level was, of course, already available, but that isn't enough because the file systems don't understand columns. And trying to teach HDFS about where columns are in the file just seemed like a complete non-starter. So we wanted to change the file formats, and we wanted it so that the readers had to do nothing other than have access to the key material. We wanted it so that when you're reading the data, nothing had to change. The reader just looks at the file, says, oh, there's encrypted data there. Do I have access to the key? If yes, you see the encrypted data. Otherwise, you get the masked values with no more interaction on the reader side. Because these formats are columnar, we can decrypt the data only as necessary, and we need to manage the master keys. The user should never, ever, ever get access to the master keys. You want to make sure the keys are only on the KMS, preferably with a hardware-based key manager behind them, and that they never leave that key manager. And we needed support for key rolling. Anytime you have a long-term secret, that introduces lots of problems. And so you want to be able to roll those automatically and make sure that that rolling isn't disruptive. You want to make sure that you continue to read the old data that was written before the key was rolled, but write new data with the new version of the key. So what solutions do you have right now? As we've talked about, transparent encryption does a lot. It lets you encrypt whole directory trees. You get a unique key, master key for each zone, and then each file actually has a local key. And the client decrypts the data, so it's reasonably efficient. When we put this in, we created a key provider API that did key management, and that interface has been implemented by the Cloud Air Manager, the Hadoop ecosystem has one, and the Ranger also. What are the problems? It's very coarse protection. You can only encrypt whole subtrees. So if you go back to the Hive example, you could encrypt a whole table, you could encrypt the whole warehouse, or you could encrypt particular partitions. Either any of those would work, but then you can't do anything finer grained than that. So you can't get any column level security out of that. You also, a lot of users need access to those keys. And as always with security, the more people that have access to a key, the more dangerous it is. And that creates a lot of vulnerabilities because the more people that have access to those keys, you've got a lot more potential for problems. Finally, when moving data between zones, it becomes a copy because it has to completely rewrite the data. And so similar to the problems you have in S3 with moving data around, you end up with a lot of this kind of problem. And Hive was particularly bad. I believe we fixed all of the problems with this by keeping temporary directories in local zones. But before we did it, like, you'd get three copies of the data because it was moving to this temp directory, then moving to that temp directory, and then finally moving into the final place. And so it just created a huge, huge nightmare. Actually, that one was particularly bad because Hive was using its own output committer rather than using the standard MapReduce one. And so we had to fix it lots. Okay. Now, the other thing you see people do is use Hive Server 2 or LLP. That gives you access to column-level encryption, protection. You can say who can see which column, and it actually even gives you the Ranger-level masking and limitations. So you can actually do a lot with this, but it means that you've just given up one of Hadoop's huge, huge advantages, which is that the user gets to control how to access the data, right? If they want to access it with SQL, they can access it with SQL. If they need to access it from Spark, they can access it from Spark. If they have to go through Hive Server 2, now, first of all, you've got to make sure Hive Server 2 is deployed and up and running, but you also need, you have cut off the access for everyone who doesn't want to do SQL. And you also have the problem of getting data back through JDBC. Now, there is a Spark to LAP connector that addresses that. It pulls the data back in bulk, actually through Apache Avro. Arrow, not Avro. And so you can actually pull data back, but then what it looks like is your Spark has to farm out a subquery to LAP to run, get those results back through that connector, and then it can do its own processing. So it works, but it's not as convenient as you'd like. The other solution I've seen people do previously was to create separate tables, where you'd pull all of the PII information into a completely separate table, and then you control access to that separate table, or even worse, have that table on a separate cluster so that you could restrict access. That creates a huge operational nightmare for the users because now you've, or for the administrators, because now you've got data on this table that has to stay synced with the data on that table, and anytime they're updated, they have to be updated together. It's just really hard to keep everything synchronized and accessed, and you get huge, huge performance overheads when you do that. So that one's not the super happy path. And finally, there are actually some encryption UDFs in Hive. Those would give you encryption, but unfortunately, they're UDFs, and so they don't have a way of dealing with the key material, so you actually end up passing the key material as part of the query. That's bad, because it gets logged. This is really, really not a good way of dealing with it. It also happens to leak a fair amount of information about it, because each value is getting encrypted, and therefore you can tell the difference between a null value and a real value, because an encrypted null value is really small, and a real value is significantly larger. And so you get a fair amount of information about the value underneath the encryption. So what did we do? Well, we had the columnar file format, and so we were like, okay, it's already writing the data in columns. It's written in columns for two things, actually. The first is column projection, because often when you're querying a table, you only need a few out of many columns. So we see a lot of queries where you need 10 out of 100 columns, and you don't want to read all those bytes and decompress those bytes and deserialize them. The other one is you get better compression. If you're compressing all the states, for example, you can compress them really well because you know that these values are all related to each other. When you mix it up with the other data in the row, then it gets harder to compress well. Encryption works really well for this because now we can only encrypt the bytes for the column that we need, and we can store multiple variants of the data. This is what the work file format looks like. Basically, you end up reading it backwards because the metadata is at the foot of the file. You find where the stripes are located, then within the stripe, the piece is the stripe footer, and that tells you where the pieces inside the stripe are located. And you end up with streams per column, and you can find the pieces that you need to read. So the nice part about this, because the directory flows downwards, that means that we could add other pieces of the file that old readers don't worry about, right? Because nothing insists on everything being contiguous. So when we wanted to add extra bytes for the encrypted stuff without breaking old readers, we could add new streams into the list, and if it didn't recognize the type, it would just ignore it. And so that's effectively what we did. We basically added new streams, and the old readers will just ignore the new encrypted streams. But what does this look like from the user side? We basically defined two new properties for your table. Now that's important, right? You don't want to put this in the config. You want to make this in the table property so that you define what is going to happen on this table from then on. And so you define org.encrypt and you say, okay, I want to use the PII key to encrypt SSN and email. And I want to use the credit key to encrypt the card info. Now, you can also optionally define how to mask the unencrypted one in this case, and this would say, I want to use SHA-256 to mask the card info. We'll talk more about masking in a few slides, but I wanted to put the two pieces together. So those two pieces are given to the writer And that is enough to tell it to talk to the key server, get those keys, mask and encrypt those columns, and everything else flows automatically. Now, you do need to tell it where the key provider is. Okay, a little history on ORC. ORC is set up to run with a wide number of, or wide range of Hadoop versions. The key provider API that we put in was put in Hadoop 2.7. Now, most, we could have just said, okay, ORC doesn't work with Hadoop older than Hadoop 2.7. But we decided that we wanted to keep the current one, which we've got a really old version that we support back to. And so we actually created a new key provider API for ORC, and we made a shim that if you haven't defined anything, will automatically, and you're using Hadoop 2.7 or newer, then it'll use the Hadoop key provider API. So actually, if you've got HDFS encryption set up, you already have all the configs you need to use ORC key, the Hadoop key management server as your ORC key management. Now, how do you want to manage these keys? The first one is that you want to create a key for each protection level you want. So if you want to protect the PII keys, that works. If you want to create the PCI for credit card stuff, you'd create a PCI key, and HIPAA would be for medical. And if you have multiple levels, then you would create the levels that you need. But this is effectively your level of authorization because you're going to control who has access to those keys. So you would create a key for each level that you needed to control and go from there. Now, we don't actually use those master keys to do the encryption. What we do instead is each column in each file gets a unique local key that was created randomly for that file. And then we ask the KMS, okay, decrypt this or encrypt this for me. We put the encrypted key in the bottom of the ORC file. So the ORC file reader can get the encrypted local key, try to decrypt it. If it has permissions, it'll get the decrypted key. Otherwise, it'll get told no. And then the user will get the mask values instead. So this means that now we can control access to those columns by setting up Ranger policies to access who has access to those keys. And it's not global access, right? It's you don't get the PII key, and you can use that for everything that's encrypted with PII. It's only for that column for that file. So you've got pretty limited access. I will say that you could hold on to those keys, but because it's only for that file, it's just the data that you could have copied out manually anyway. And so, sure, it's shorter than copying the data out manually, but you haven't gained anything else, right? You've just got the data that you could have read and that you're in the audit log as having read. So you haven't gained anything. You just have a little bit shorter thing you could if you were trying to sneak out a key. And, of course, because Ranger lets you control the access levels, then you can control who has access to the keys, when they have access, where they have access, and so on. I guess one of the key pieces there would be if you wanted to control different geocodes, you actually could create a PII for Europe versus a PII for the US and give people different levels of control that way. So the key provider API, it provides limited access to the encryption keys, and it just encrypts and decrypts local keys. They never see the master key. It does support versions and key rolling. So like I said, you can decrypt old versions of the master key, and the ORC file actually records which version of the key it was that was used. So, the key provider API also supports third-party plugins, so it would be easy to make an implementation to use the Amazon key management server or Google Community Management Server. All of those are would be relatively straightforward to do. What does it look like? Now, obviously, one of the things we absolutely couldn't do is every time we have a value to decrypt, go talk to the KMS. That would never, ever scale. Hadoop is really good at destroying any single server that you access from your cloud. So instead, we made it so that you just have to decrypt that local key once, and then you can read the whole file with just the one interaction. If you came to the Parquet encryption talk, then you saw that the overheads actually aren't very high for using the KMS. So what happens? You submit the task. The task looks at the ORC file, gets the encrypted key, then asks the KMS to decrypt the local key. It gets back the local key, and then it can read the encrypted data and decrypt it locally. So all the encrypted data is staying in the user's task, and none of the decryption other than the decrypting the key is done by the KMS. The random key is local. The local key is random. It's encrypted. Actually, we already said all this. Sorry about that. One thing that you have to be extremely careful with AES CTR, actually CTR in general, is that you never, ever, ever reuse an IV. IV is the initialization vector that makes sure that each encryption is unique with the same local key. So we actually generate those IVs explicitly so that we are guaranteed that they never get reused within a file, and because the local keys are never reused between files, you're guaranteed that you're never reusing the same IV with multiple instances of the same local key. And so, yeah, we put all kinds of pieces to make sure that we don't reuse them. We put the column, the kind, the stripe, and the counter. Okay, so masking. I showed you the control for masking. It was easy to say. But masking is what happens when you don't have access to the key. When the user is trying to read a column that they don't have access to, this is what happens. And my first pass was just to use nullify. I was just like, okay, they get null values, that would be great. The Ranger guys were like, well, nullify would be great, but there are a lot of cases we want more control than that. And we want to be able to simulate the dynamic masking that Ranger does, but statically so that the users can get a masked version. So we made a couple of masks as part of the column encryption work. The default one is nullify, because that is the safe one, where all values that were encrypted become null. The next one is redact. That one will take it so that you get X's instead of letters and nines instead of numbers. You actually can control the mapping, and you can also define parts to leave unmasked. So that's the one that you would use if it's a credit card number and you want to like mask everything except for the first four or the last four, whichever one works for your use case. For zip codes, for example, you may want to just let them see the first three digits and make the last two zeros, right? That's a common one for zip codes. Not perfect. There are cases where that does bad things, but it generally works. Now, if you need the users who don't have access to be able to join, that's when you typically use a hash function, right? So if you want the users to be able to join between multiple tables, then you would use SHA-256. And that lets them join on it without being able to read the data. So what kind of cases would you want to do that? That would be things like credit card numbers or I don't know. What a good example, actually, that one is. And finally, we allow custom user-defined ones. Now, I can't talk about data masking without talking about the problems inherent in anonymization. Anonymization has been tried a lot, and there have been a lot of problems. The first one was AOL released some search logs, right? They, of course, cut off the username, but they left an identifier that was unique for each user so that you could do session analysis. The problem is that people often search for themselves. And so the vanity searches actually de-anonymized a non-trivial amount of the data. Because if someone is searching for someone that isn't famous, they're highly likely searching for themselves to see what Google knows about them. And so actually people de-anonymize themselves by searching. Another case that happened was the Netflix Machine Learning Prize, right? When they put out the data, of course all the usernames were stripped out and it wasn't obvious how it was a problem, right? But then people started saying, oh, we can compare the reviews of movies between IMDb and Netflix data set, and they could identify people based on the similarity between the reviews of the same movies. Another case that came out was the New York City taxi data set. When they first did it, they hashed the taxi medallions with MD5. You're like, okay, that's okay, because they aren't putting the actual taxi medallion. The problem is the taxi medallions are all assigned sequentially from one. So it's easy to generate the first 10,000 numbers and check the hashes, and then you could de-anonymize it. They also included the longe and lat, where every taxi ride was picked up and dropped off. In downtown Manhattan, that is effectively anonymous. You really can't tell anything, especially with a 30-foot error bar on the data. However, some of the taxi rides either started or went out to places out in the country. From those, a 30-foot error bar is more than enough to de-anonymize it, at least to an address. And so there it actually was a bad anonymization. And so I do ask you, when you're masking the data, think about the trade-offs in the anonymization. Think hard about how someone could try to de-anonymize it and pay attention to it. One of the useful techniques is tokenization, where you just say, okay, I am going to ignore the initial value and always replace the user with the same identifier without any additional meaning behind it, right? So if O'Malley at Apache is always assigned an ID, that ID doesn't have any meaning, that would be a better anonymization than like using the hash function, right? If you use the hash function on an email address, it's not that hard to sweep through the Apache accounts and figure out who's who. So a tokenization would be anonymous, hash not so much. All right, now one of the use cases that's an interesting one for this kind of stuff is actually not related to authorization, but instead about anonymizing data after 90 days. So some of the web companies have problems out of after 90 days. And so one way to do that with the key rolling is by rolling a new key every day. Every day's data will get that version of the key to encrypt the local keys. And if you decrypt the master key after 90 days, now all of a sudden no one can go back and pull that data back out again. So they could still keep the local key, right, as always, but you would have made it much, much harder to decrypt old data and keep it after the 90 days. Currently, of course, people rewrite that data twice, right? They'll write one copy with the PII and one copy without the PII and then delete the PII copy. But that, again, creates a huge headache for the ops guys. All right, so let me dive down into the next level. So what happens right now is we end up writing both copies of the streams, right? You write the masked data and the unmasked data. Now, That, of course, does mean your files are a little larger, although if the mask is nullify, that compresses really well. Even without the zlib, the run length encoding, I think I calculated out that for every 1,000 rows, you're getting 3 bytes. Now, those 3 bytes are going to be the same for every 1,000 rows, so if you do zlib on top, it stays really small. I'm not that worried about it. Now, if you do the hashing, then your data is going to get larger, and so you're going to pay more costs there. But those are the trade-offs that you pay when you start looking at the more complicated masking things. We encrypt both the data and the statistics, right? The statistics tell you a lot about the data. They tell you the min value, the max value, and the sum and a bunch of other data. We didn't want to expose that, especially min and max are especially bad. And the ORC keeps statistics at the 10,000 row level, the stripe level, which is roughly 256 megabytes, and then at the file level. And so you'd actually get a lot of min-max pairs as you went through the data. We were able to maintain compatibility for old readers. They always get the unencrypted variant. And we preserved the ability to seek within the file. So you can seek not only in ORC. The indexes actually let you seek to every 10,000 rows. And so you can continue to do that even with the encrypted data. So, the streams go through a pipeline. Currently, they do run length encoding and then the compression. Actually, there are two more now. There are Z standard and LZ4. And we added the encryption as an optional step at the end. And obviously, when you're reading, it goes through backwards. As to why it has to go that order, obviously, after you encrypt, the zlib isn't going to be able to do anything more. Now, one of the side benefits of the fact that we're encrypting the whole column together means that you can't get any information about a particular value, right? You aren't going to be able to tell whether a particular value is null or not because that whole column has been encrypted and compressed together. So you won't get any information about any particular value based on the compression size. The encryption is all ASCTR. CTR is incredibly convenient because it allows the seek, and it doesn't require adding any padding. A lot of encryption requires padding out to the 16-bit or 16-byte. Actually, there's an amusing piece there. In Hadoop, originally, the security was based on the delegation tokens. The user or the developer put in 16 to an API to Java. They thought they were getting 16-byte security. They got 16-bit security. So for the first couple years of Hadoop, we had 16-bit security, high security. But fortunately, we found and fixed that one a while ago. But CTR doesn't require any padding, so it's and allows seeking, so that's really convenient. Okay, so what does this look like? We've got ORC column encryption, obviously the Parquet column encryption is also going along. It provides transparent encryption. It provides multi-paradigm column security. It lets you use your old readers. The old readers just get the mask values. They don't get the encrypted values. It provides static masking, and it gives you audit logging via the KMS logging. It supports file merging. So ORC, particularly under Hive, has an ability to take multiple small files and just concatenate them together without rewriting the data. And that actually is preserved with column encryption. And so we made that work. And it's been released in ORC 1.6. Integration with other tools. Hive and Spark are actually easy because it's just a table property. We have to do a little bit of work, but not a whole lot. Now, some of the pieces like create a select need to be done, but fundamentally, there's not a whole lot of work there. LAP, on the other hand, is going to be problematic. In particular, it provides caching and fast processing of SQL queries. That cache part is the biggest problem, because now you've got to be able to cache the encrypted and the unencrypted data and give people access to the right pieces. And you need the audit log to reflect the end user, not LAP. And unfortunately, the LAP guys access ORC at a really, really low level under the APIs, and those APIs changed. And so that's going to not be a fun integration, unfortunately. Now, what are the limitations? You need the encryption policy for write. So Apache Atlas provides a way of tagging data and letting those tags flow through. That generally works because the tags are controlling the access. And so for Ranger, that works. Unfortunately, in this case, because you need the tags before you write the data, you really want the annotations to be there before you write the first data. And if you wanted to do auto-discovery of those tags, then you'd need to pre-scan the data before it was available to users. Changing the masking policy obviously involves rewriting files because it's static masking, right? You don't have a way of dynamically changing it. But on the other hand, everyone will get consistent masking, right? Spark and Hive and Presto will all see the same masking because they're using the same data to do it. We need additional data masks, credit cards, addresses, that kind of fun stuff. And decrypted local keys could be saved. All right, that's my talk. Oops, I left Srikanth on the presentation. He wasn't here. Any questions? Yes, Ryan. So Ryan asked about column renaming. And so ORC schema evolution is name-based. So right now, the schema evolution would not be happy with you renaming columns. Obviously, if you came in through Iceberg and had Iceberg managing your renames, then it would track the way that Iceberg would expect. But Hive users actually tend to expect the name-based. There is actually a switch that let you do positional, but it would. Currently, if you wrote new data with the column renamed, it would use the current table properties to pick which columns to encrypt.
And is there a different policy for who can rename columns versus write to a table?
So the question is, you've got this microphone now. So no, there isn't one for the renamed columns. On the other hand, the ORC files, because they contain all the metadata, it's not like you would lose the old data, right? So old ORC files would continue to work because the metadata is in the file footer. New ones, it will follow the name, so you would need the name to match for the column encryption to hit. Now, we did actually use the type attributes that you had us add for Iceberg to control the encryption. So actually, if you set it on that way, then it would just work. So we basically defined a type attribute that's how to encrypt and how to mask. So if you use those, then it'll just work. But we also defined the table property so that it would work for people who didn't want to define, who weren't using the API, basically. Yes? A question right there.
So when you do the masking, when the query engine like a Hive retrieving those mask value, is there some like flag that it can know it is mask value? Otherwise, you don't want the Hive use like a min, max on those hashed values, right?
So, okay, that because the file reader is handling all the translations between the masked and the unmasked, the query engine doesn't need to know anything. So it'll get the min-max for the masked values, not the min-max for the unmasked values, if they don't have the key. If they do have the key, then they get the min-max for the encrypted data. And getting that piece right was trickier than it should have been. Absolutely.
Any other questions?
I didn't quite understand in your diagrams how Apache Ranger was falling into that. Was that your key management server?
So Ranger provides the key management server. It also is how most of the people currently are controlling access to the data. So it provides the dynamic masking. It provides the row limitations and column limitations. But in the context of the encryption, yes, we're just using it as the KMS. And controlling who has access to the keys. Yeah, it's a little hard to see the people in the back.
Any other questions? Okay. In that case.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Owen.